Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful, rainy Thursday morning in New York. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I have a wonderful guest with me today, Mary Cleaver, and I'll tell you more about her in a little while. But before I get started, I want to tell you about some of the things going on in the area that are very exciting. As a matter of fact, today I have a meeting for the Small Farm Summit. The Long Island Small Farm Summit is having our first meeting to start planning for the 2014 Small Farm Summit. And one of the initiatives, of the Small Farm Summit was to have ongoing workshops, to have workshops on beekeeping and backyard chicken raising and straw bale gardening and things like that. And so we are putting together a schedule of workshops that we hope to have starting this spring throughout the year, working up towards our Small Farm Summit meeting or conference in 2014. So, of course, as the year goes on, you'll be hearing about all those workshops, and I'll give you information where you can sign up for them. March 3rd to 5th is the International Restaurant and Food Service Show of New York, and that's at the Javits Center. And I always like to go to that mostly to see all the crap. Most of it is stuff you wouldn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole, but there's always new stuff coming out, and you know, there's also new stuff for packaging and recycled plasticware and things like that. So I go for those reasons. But sometimes you can find some really wonderful organic dried mushrooms or fair trade organic chocolate, things like that that are newer to the market. And are, you know, it's wonderful to go to a place where you can find the connections and make find ways to source these other products that might enhance your menu items. So I always like to go to that. March 6th, I am actually giving a workshop at the Waldorf Cafeteria in Garden City. That's my old home front. I used to run the cafeteria there for a few years and transform their lunch program into a healthy eating cafe. And I'll be giving a workshop called Simplicity Cooking, an evening to inspire family time in the kitchen. And the goal of this is to encourage parents to bring their kids into the kitchen with them and to do family cooking. I hear so often from moms that, you know, how crazy they get coming home from work. The kids are home. They haven't seen the kids all day. And how they feel guilty plopping them in front of a TV and making dinner. And I don't want to say to them, you should, but instead I try to encourage them to invite the kids into the kitchen with you and let them help you make dinner. There's so many things kids can do, from setting the table to peeling the carrots to chopping. I mean, if you teach your children early on how to chop vegetables, they can be great sous chefs. So it's really wonderful to bring the kids in to let them see what it's like for real food to get prepared, and it can be a really wonderful, joyous time in the kitchen. So I encourage people to do that, and that is what I will be demonstrating at this workshop called Simplicity Cooking. So that's March 6th at 7:30 at the cafeteria at the Waldorf School in Garden City. So you can call the Waldorf School to sign up for that. On March 10th, there is a bus from Long Island, and I believe there's also buses from New York City, to tour Pennsylvania fracking sites. And there's nothing like seeing a fracking site up close. I mean, I've seen many, many pictures, and I have been told I have not gone to see the fracking sites, and unfortunately I won't be able to make this bus, but from what I have heard, there's nothing like going and seeing it firsthand. And so Food and Water Watch has arranged for buses on Long Island. There's two different pickups, one in Millville on 110 and one in Roslyn at Christopher Morley Park. They're the same pickup spots that we used for the buses going to D.C. for the Forward on Climate rally. And the buses will leave at 7 o'clock at Millville and 7:15, and they'll be returning around 6:45, 7 o'clock at night. But they're going to take you to Pennsylvania to see some of the fracking sites, and you'll get a firsthand experience of the devastation that fracking is causing on these communities. So if you can make that, that would be wonderful. March 13th is the No Farms, No Food rally up in Albany. And I did that the last couple of years, and it's really growing. It's a wonderful opportunity to really meet people up close. You get to go into your legislators' offices, senators and assemblymen, and talk to them about why you want to see bills passed that support young farmer programs, that support saving our farmland, because if we don't save our farmland, we will not have the food to feed all of us. So we are losing so many farms every year, thousands and thousands of acres, and we really need to turn this trend around. And so there need to be more incentives and more programs from the government, both on the state level and on the national level, to support these initiatives. So anyway, we will be meeting with our senators and assemblymen, and usually they break up into groups of six people at a time, going into the office and really talking with the legislator, and it's a wonderful experience. So if you can make it to that, that's March 13th up in Albany, starting at 10 o'clock. And there are buses from New York City, and there are scholarships for those buses as well if you can't afford it. So please come. March 14th, the Sustainable Institute at Molloy College has their monthly film series. This is the Island President, and the president of Maldives is transitioning their whole country or their whole island into a sustainable agricultural island, and it should be a great movie. I'm planning to go to that. So again, that's March 14th if you can make it. So now I want to share a recipe with you before I invite Mary Cleaver on to join us. And this recipe is roasted tempeh with vegetables in a light coconut curry sauce. And I say light because it's not very saucy, and it's not a heavy sauce. It's light because we're going to have it for lunch today at the Small Farm Summit meeting. So the recipe is enough for 20 people, so you can cut it down if you're not making it for a large group of people. But one of the things that I have found when I'm cooking with tempeh is where I used to saute it and have to turn each little piece over so that the whole piece of tempeh got golden brown, now I roast it in the oven. And it's a great way of getting the whole cube of tempeh golden brown. And so I cut the tempeh. My standard way of cutting it is I take the block of tempeh, I cut it in half across the narrow width, and then I cut it in half lengthwise, and then I cut each of those quarters down the middle laterally so that they're thinner. Because the trick I found with tempeh is that many people don't like the flavor of the inside of the tempeh if it's not cooked well. So by cutting it thinner, you get all of the tempeh really cooked well, and that is really a key to people liking the tempeh. So I cut the tempeh into small cubes, and then I toss it on a baking sheet with some olive oil. And you can also just coat the bottom of the baking sheet with olive oil and then put the tempeh on and spray the top of the tempeh with olive oil, and that will work as well. And then roast it in an oven, high temperature, like 450 degrees for about 15-20 minutes. Just keep a watch on it because everyone's oven is different. And usually it will get golden brown all over you. It does not even require turning it, but if you see that the bottom is getting golden brown quicker than the top, you certainly can turn it over. And the goal is to remove it when all of the tempeh is golden brown. So that's step number one. Once you pull it out of the oven, you can sprinkle it with some tamari so that it takes on a little bit of the saltiness of tamari, and that will be added to the stir fry towards the end. So what you need for the stir fry is 2 large onions cut in half and then sliced into crescent moons, 4 to 6 carrots cut into julienne strips, 3 heads of broccoli cut into flowerettes, 4 small zucchinis cut lengthwise and then cut into crescent moons, 2 red peppers cut into thin strips, 1 pound of mushrooms, whatever kind you have, whether it's portobello, shiitake, or white mushrooms. Ginger, I used a 3-inch wide piece. I mean, it was a big chunk of ginger, and I grated that and kept that on the side. 10 cloves of garlic, also chopped very fine or pureed in a little mini Cuisinart. 2 tablespoons Aji Marin, which is sweet rice wine, not to be mistaken by Hikoman, put that a marin in the supermarket. That is really glucose syrup, and that is not what you want. You want real organic Aji Marin. Eden makes a brand that's really great. I'm sure there's others, but that's the one that I find at Whole Foods all the time. Olive oil for sautéing. 1 can of coconut milk. 1 tablespoon of red curry paste, 1 tablespoon of tamari, and 1/4 cup of chopped parsley. So you're going to cover the bottom of a wok with the olive oil. And when the oil is just getting hot, you're going to add the onions and carrots. And one thing with olive oil, people always ask me, you know, is it okay to cook with olive oil? The idea with olive oil is you don't want to let it smoke. You want to get it hot, but before it starts smoking, you want to add the vegetables. Because once it starts smoking, the molecular makeup of the olive oil starts changing and it becomes not a healthy oil, where before that it is a healthy oil. So you want to avoid letting the olive oil smoke. But when the oil's hot, you can add the onions and carrots. And you always start with the root vegetables. They take longer to cook, so you always start your stir-fry with that. If I was adding parsnips or burdock root, I'd add those now as well. So the onions and carrots get added now. Cook that for about 5 minutes, and you can add the garlic and the ginger and continue cooking for about 5 more minutes. If you need more oil, you can add more oil. If you want to keep it less fat, you can add some water at that point just to help steam the vegetables. Then you're going to add the broccoli and stir for a few more minutes. Then add the peppers and the zucchini. Again, add either a little more water or olive oil to keep the stir-frying working so that it's not sticking to the bottom of the wok. And you're going to cook for a few more minutes. Then you're going to add the mirin, and that will also help steam the vegetables. In a separate bowl, you want to make a sauce with the can of coconut milk, the curry paste, and the tamari. And just mix that well so that you mix up the curry paste, and the coconut milk at this point will look a beautiful red color. And you're going to add that to the vegetables and mix that well with the vegetables. And at the very end, you add chopped parsley. And you can serve it with brown rice, quinoa, rice noodles, whatever grain you like. And it's a wonderful dish. And like I said, it's not a heavy curry sauce, so it's really, you know, a really nice vegetable dish in the afternoon. It won't be too heavy. And that's what we're going to have after this show. So I hope you all enjoy it. Now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest today, Mary Cleaver. Mary is the owner of the Cleaver Company, a New York City catering company specializing in organic, seasonal food, and whose core belief is that food must please the eye, delight the palate, and satisfy the conscience. Zagat considers the Cleaver Company one of the top 3 caterers in New York City. She also owns the Green Table, which is a farm-to-table restaurant in the Chelsea Market, where guests can enjoy delicious dishes that demonstrate a commitment to seasonal cuisine. Before establishing the Cleaver Company, Mary was a cooking teacher, a corporate chef, a pastry chef, and a food stylist. She's also the co-author of the Tribeca Cookbook, which unfortunately is out of print. I tried to get a copy before this show, but I'm going to keep looking for a nice used copy. She's also a graduate of Bennington College, great school up in Vermont. Mary was named the first ever snail blazer by Slow Food New York City to honor her contributions creating better, healthier food for all. She's the founder of Farm to Chef Network and a board member of Food Systems Network, New York City, and Local Infrastructure for Local Agriculture, among other professional affiliations. She remains one of the foremost authorities on local, sustainable food and sourcing in the United States, and is a sought-after speaker on the subject. On any given morning, you'll find Mary down at the Green Market, purchasing fruit, vegetables, flowers, and much more from our local farmers. Mary, are you with me?
I'm here, Bhavani. Thank you.
Oh, it's so such a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, likewise. Thank you for that lovely recipe.
Oh, enjoy.
Wish I was with you for lunch today.
Yes, well, you're welcome to come. Maybe you'll be our speaker. speaker at the Small Farm Summit. You'd be great.
Okay.
Have you come to the Small Farm Summit yet? We've had two.
I have not. No, I didn't know about it.
Oh, it's a great thing. Ann Cooper and was keynote speaker last year, as well as Will.
How wonderful.
And Joel Salatin was the year before. So.
Oh, how fantastic.
Yeah. So anyway, how did you get started?
Ann is one of my heroes, for sure.
Yes, all of ours. All of ours. So how did you get started in catering and restaurant work?
Well, that's a long story. I really I moved to New York from North Bennington, Vermont, where I had been living, and went to college, and I studied ceramics and painting, and I needed a job, and really there were no jobs available there.
Do you know that I went to the New York State College of Ceramics. I also went to art school and got into cooking.
Oh,
I didn't go
great.
To cooking school either.
Well, they're very closely related. You know,
absolutely.
You take this wonderful raw material that comes from the earth,
uh-huh.
and you know, work with it, and then and change it, and then apply heat, and you have a whole nother thing. So.
Right. Right.
It's a very similar process, and there's always a lot of cooking events evolved around, you know, the ceramic studio.
Right.
So food is a big part of the ceramics world, I would say. Certainly you're making vessels for food a lot, or,
uh-huh.
you know, anyway. So, and the processes are very, as I said, similar. So, I had always loved to cook growing up as a kid, and I did a lot of cooking for my family, and, you know, I just started out, actually, my first job in New York was as a dishwasher, working for a fancy food shop on the Upper East Side, and then eventually they let me cook there and wait on customers, and sometimes people would come in and they'd want to buy food for a dinner party and they'd need somebody to serve it, so I volunteered to do that, and that's how I met my first clients. After I left that job after 6 months, because it was quite difficult. We weren't allowed to sit down for 12 hours a day or take a break. I went to Montana for a ceramics workshop actually all summer, and then I came back to New York and I wrote to some of the women that I had, whose homes I had been in, and said, I'm now catering on my own, and they hired me. So I started doing small dinner parties from my five-flight walk up on Mulberry Street. And my friend Shannon, who was an excellent waiter and a dancer, she and I would make hors d'oeuvres on the ironing board, and off we'd go to Midtown with, you know, mm-hmm. dinner. So that's how I started. And then it still is a word-of-mouth business, my catering business. But I've been doing it for 35 years now, so it's and you know, you're just as good as your last job, essentially.
Right.
So,
right. Very interesting.
And then I opened the restaurant 10 years ago. It was very, very, very tiny at first. I'm an original tenant of the Chelsea Market, so I've been here for 16 years, and this is the third kitchen that I built here in Chelsea, or the third kitchen. Is this one in Chelsea. And I realized at a certain point that it would be advantageous to have a restaurant, because I wanted to have a space where people could come and enjoy farm-to-table cuisine and really learn about it and learn where their food was coming from and understand how important it is to know that, and have it available to a wider audience, because catering is kind of a large financial commitment, but having a meal at the green table is not. So.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, were you always focused on local food, or did that kind of develop over the years?
Well, you know, I'm just old enough to have grown up eating local food. I grew up in the Northeast and, you know, in New Jersey and southeastern Massachusetts and then in Vermont. So, you know, these are all places that have riches of natural resources and gardening and good food product. New Jersey is the Garden State. It was,
uh-huh.
And so you know, we had great produce there from farm stands, and then in southeastern Massachusetts, where I spent a lot of time in the summer, we had delicious, you know, just delicious produce. It was a very long growing season and temperate because of the ocean, and. Wonderful fish and shellfish, and you know, I grew up clamming and gathering mussels, and you know, just, you know, we would just eat with the seasons. And so when I moved to the marketplace of the world, New York City, I was just really surprised that I couldn't find local food here. The first year I worked in the food industry here in New York, there were no local tomatoes in the city in the summertime, but the first raspberries came from Chile in February. And I can still remember seeing them come, you know, this little pint of raspberries for $7, and people just thinking, oh my goodness, how wonderful, we can have raspberries in February. But, you know, they didn't taste very good, and they were very expensive.
But that's more recent, right? The raspberries from Chile.
That was in the late 70s.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The first time, you know, flown in. And then there was, you know, I mean, food has been moving around the globe forever. You know, the hills of Rome are built on the amphora that they shipped the olive oil in from Spain, you know. So moving food around the globe is something that I'm not opposed to that.
Right.
I just think that when something is in season, you eat it
locally
because it tastes better.
Right.
It tastes better. And also, it is really important to develop a regional farm and food economy to keep the land and farming, and to keep the farmers farming, and to keep local food on our table. So,
Well, that your story about the raspberries, that was like 35 years ago. So, how have you seen it change now?
Well, Bob Lewis and Adrian Benepe began the green market system in New York, also in the late 70s. And when I discovered that, I became a much happier person. And I began developing relationships with the producers there. I mean, I still spend a lot of time at the green market, but have also, you know, subsequently since then, you know, developed a broader scope of producers locally to work with. But there are now over 50 green markets in the Grow NYC system in New York City. So it's just, the progress has been tremendous. And, and I do kind of fantasize that, you know, in 20 years we'll look back on this period, as this past 50 years as sort of being a blip on the historical screen, and we will have been able to reinstate, you know, a broader understanding of why it's important to eat locally and to eat food that is grown in a healthy way, because that's key.
Right.
That we will begin to really, really have a, you know, put in the past this this food system that we have now, which is sort of actively poisoning our population.
Right. Absolutely. Now, when you are at the green market, do you distinguish between locally grown or locally grown and organic? You know, very often people ask me, you know, if you have to choose between locally grown or organic, which do you choose?
Yeah.
And I know which I choose, and I'm curious as to which you choose.
Well, the ideal is
both.
Organic, locally grown.
Of course.
Yeah. And otherwise it's just a navigation. A lot of producers, you know, I mean, I definitely seek out the producers who are, to my mind, the best stewards of the land, who are, you know, they may not be, you know, certified organic, they may not have 100%, you know, organic growing in their lexicon, but they are really actively involved and understanding that they are making decisions based on the seventh generation, not just what's happening to them right now, right here, you know.
Yeah. Because I know I had a talk with a farmer at TEDx Manhattan, which, by the way, everybody, Mary catered, and it was so good.
Thank you.
But I had a discussion with this farmer who's out on Long Island, who I was asking him whether he's organic, because he's placed in the supermarkets, like Whole Foods anyway, you know. Beautiful packaging. I mean, it is plastic, but, you know, it looks like they'd be organic, but they're not. And I asked him that, and he said, well, you know, he goes, you know, this is my livelihood, and if it's, you know, do I spray or do I lose my whole crop and go in the hole? Well, he goes, I'm going to spray. But he doesn't spray always. And, you know, I do feel the struggle that farmers are facing, you know. It's like, if you lose your whole crop, you do,
absolutely,
financially, you can go down.
And that's right.
If you're out of business, then that's not good for anybody either. So.
Yeah. And there are actually some, you know, the, I mean, organic producers are allowed to use certain kinds of pesticides, you know, and a lot of them are copper-based. But, you know, copper is actually very powerful, and there are some pesticides that are chemically produced that are less invasive, actually. So it's, there's a lot that, you know, each, farmers are artists and scientists, you know, and, you know, it's important to establish a dialogue and maintain a dialogue with your producers to know, and to know what they're doing and what decisions they're making and why, and, you know, you
right.
gain an understanding and respect for that.
Right, not just to put everyone in a box, so you're not organic,
yeah.
you're bad,
the,
you know, and that's not true either.
That's right. The USDA certified organic standards have many problems, actually, you know, particularly in terms of animal welfare. And there are many farmers who work beyond organics, you know, beyond the certified organic standards or outside of them, but it doesn't mean that their practices are not good.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I agree with you. It's good to talk to the farmer. You know, we're talking about still, I'm sure you agree, the local, smaller farmer who's not, you know, not a agribusiness, you know, who's really working the land.
Well, but right. I mean, in the Northeast, I mean, we do work with, you know, fruit producers who have, you know, who are farming a lot, who have a lot of land and orchards, you know, and growing fruit in the Northeast is something that is tricky to do organically because of the climate. But, you know, there are ways of approaching your orchards in a very sensible way that, again, are not certified organic, but that are life-giving, that are nonetheless life-giving. I mean, that's what you want your food to be, is life-giving.
Mm-hmm.
And so working with nature is something that the farmer has to do. And there are all kinds of decisions and navigations that have to be made on a daily and a seasonal basis. And it's been a tough couple of years in the Northeast for farming between Hurricane Irene and Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, it's been and the changing climate.
Right.
Lots of, you know, lots of drought, lots of water at the wrong time, heat too early, you know. The apple
right.
crop was really in trouble.
And not cold enough in the winter so
yeah.
that,
right.
you know, the bugs that you expect to die don't die
exactly.
and they come back stronger. And yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's really tricky. I know I have gained such an appreciation for farmers just by working the little bit of land that I work. And, you know, I recommend it to everybody, you know, to try growing things and to get an understanding for how much goes into, you know, getting that head of lettuce. You know?
Well, that's such a good point. And that's we spoke about Ann Cooper earlier. That's what she's doing is, you know, working with kids in the school system. I mean, she's working with school lunch specifically, but, you know, the goal is to have a garden in every school so the kids can understand what it is to grow food
mm-hmm.
and that food does come from the earth and that you know, it's proven that if kids grow a vegetable, they're much more likely to eat it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So.
And also, I think for everybody, if they know what goes into it, they're more willing to pay an extra dollar for this head of lettuce if they know that it is going to be not only better for them, but they're supporting their local farmer.
That's right. And we do have this notion in this country that food ought to be cheap, but it's not right. It's not a right notion.
Right.
You know, we're the only, you know, culture in the Western world that doesn't spend 25% of its income on food.
Right.
You know, you know, because good food is important to your life and to your health and to the health of the land you know, it's. There's nothing really more important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And
now, I know you, like me, are an activist as well as an expert in local sourcing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share with everyone what you see as the link between taste, food, and politics? And
well,
I know, you know, we're going to start this conversation, but it might be a long conversation. We might have to take a break in the middle, but
okay.
give it a start.
Well, you know, I think that you know, eating is eating is something that if we're fortunate we do three times a day. Not everybody is fortunate enough to do that, and that food that tastes good is it generally. Food that tastes good is going to be easier to eat, and food that's grown locally generally tastes better. So, you know, what it leads to. The more I worked more and more in the food industry, and I learned more and more about where my food was coming from, I learned more and more about the horrors of where the food was coming from, and I became much more involved in understanding not only what what I was eating, but what the animals I was eating were eating, and mm-hmm. where that food came from, and how they were raised, and how they were slaughtered, and really the point of eating is to give life. So, you know, that, and there we have had this very sensible solar system of eating that's been turned into an industrial, you know, petrochemically based system, and it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense for anyone except a few people who are making a lot of money from it. And it's, you know, I think that we really need to have in this country capitalism with values, and we need to have businesses that understand and are interested in the whole, not just, you know, one's mm-hmm. own business. So anyway, as a chef, I became more knowledgeable about the food supply, and I realized that people don't know where their food is coming from.
Right.
And so I became really interested in helping people understand that so that they could then make the better choices. And so that led to, you know, just becoming, you know, interested in being part of the solution instead of part of the problem, and educating people as best I could, and spending my buying dollars, you know, in the right places, because how we spend our dollars is how we're going to change the world, really, a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
As a chef, you know, chefs really have a responsibility. Here I am in the marketplace of New York City. There are a lot of mouths to feed here. And, you know, if I can get the right food into the mouths of the people here, that's a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we do have a responsibility as chefs to guide our clients and to guide our buying to connect, you know, the right food with our clientele.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really impossible, I think, to really be a high-quality chef and not get involved in the politics, because it's so integrated. And that's one of the things I guess I love so much about food, is that it is linked to everything. It is linked to politics and to the environment and to health and to all the things that I feel are important and that we're struggling with in our society. They're all linked around food. My intern was just showing me this morning a video that, you know, came through the email, as all these videos do, of watching a fast food chicken sandwich and a homemade real chicken sandwich left out for 4 months. And I guess they took pictures of it over time. And the fast food chicken sandwich never changed. Looked the same.
Yeah.
The bread was still soft. The chicken, not a drop of mold on
it.
Meanwhile, the regular chicken sandwich was, you know, mold, disintegrating, disgusting. But it's like, what are they putting in this food that doesn't go bad and doesn't need refrigeration? And, you know, it's scary, really scary.
Well, Tyson is in the process of developing chickens with no feathers so that they will save money on the, you know, on defeathering.
Oh, my God.
And they're having trouble with sunburn and the UV, you know. Anyway, it's just, I mean, it's I think
horrible.
We just have so much, you know, brain power and talent in this country, why are we directing it toward the wrong thing?
Right, right.
We need renewable energy. We need,
Oh, yeah, and I'm sure you saw the article in the New York Times this weekend, in the New York Times Magazine about vegan foods.
It was a really good piece, I thought, and I really appreciated the fact that he called them out on the morality issue.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it was great.
How
Everyone,
do you feel
if you haven't
about
seen
creating
it,
the obesity epidemic?
Yeah, I put a link from my website to that article.
Great.
So people can come on my website at iegreen.com and link to that website. It's great.
It's a real expose.
Let's take a couple-minute break, Mary, and then when we come back, I want to hear about the projects you're working on right now because I think they're great, and I'm right there with you. So don't go away, everyone. We'll be right back, and I'm talking with Mary Cleaver from the Cleaver Company. Be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Mary Cleaver, the owner of the Cleaver Company and the Green Table in New York City. Mary, are you with me?
I'm right here.
Great. So I was interested in the project you're working on right now, revolving around the fracking issue.
Uh-huh.
Can you share that with us?
Sure. I'm part of a group called Chefs for the Marcellus. The idea is to raise awareness about hydrofracking and the sort of perils, impending perils. And we're specifically involved with the Marcellus Shale, which is a broad area of New York State that runs from close to Vermont all the way down through Pennsylvania. And
I don't know if you heard at the beginning, I was telling people about a Food and Water Watch is sponsoring a trip this next weekend, March 10th, to go out to see some of those fracking sites in Pennsylvania.
Oh, how great.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be interesting to go and see. Food and Water Watch is doing a terrific job of raising awareness about the perils of fracking. And it's a big dilemma for chefs because we use natural gas a lot. We're very dependent on it and love to cook with it, but do not like to think that we're doing that at the expense of our food and watershed. So the problem is that the process of hydrofracking causes a tremendous amount of waste. Of perilous waste and it's very destructive to the area that and there's been a lot of evidence of animal sickness and human sickness as a result of being around the chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And the waste that's produced from the chemicals.
And there's no transparency. I mean, they don't have to tell us what those chemicals are.
No, that's the that's the Halliburton loophole. They can keep their recipe to themselves. The only positive thing that I've heard coming out of the process is the farmers in India who grow the guar for the guar gum. So it's a bean. And those farmers are benefiting tremendously. They've gone from, there's been a lot of money put into their economy because their product is very valuable all of a sudden. But the main problem with it is that it's destructive to the environment. And we still sort of are living in this idea that, still the post-industrial revolution mentality that we have endless amounts of natural resources, and the fact is that we need to understand we have to work with a natural capitalism to understand the value of our natural resources and that it's important to steward them well.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
We need to develop natural renewable energy sources, and we really need to focus on that as a culture, as an industry, because we need to put our scientific brains to work there. And even though it's less money for a few, it's greater benefit to all.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, also, the process of fracking, my understanding is that it takes three-quarters of the amount of gas to net the amount of gas that you get out, so that you're really only coming up with a 25% gain anyway for... You know, it's so wasteful, just like in the production of our ethanol, it's so wasteful.
That's right. It's hugely inefficient.
Right. And so, you know, they make you think that this is
the only way.
You're getting this huge amount from this process that is devastating the area, when the reality is you're not netting that much more. Because
correct.
It takes, you know, of the whole, let's say, I don't know what term it is, but of a gallon, it costs three-quarters of a gallon to make the gallon. So... you're really only netting 25%.
Right. And leaving a huge amount of destruction in your wake.
Absolutely.
And potentially poisoning the water supply.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and create, and it's not worth it. You're right.
Did you see the movie Dear Governor Cuomo?
I have not seen it.
It's a great one.
Yeah,
it's a great one. Everyone
that.
Out there, if you're listening, if you get a chance to see Dear Governor Cuomo, you can actually Google it, because they want everyone to see it. It's a real wake-up call to... learn about fracking, and it's done with great music, so it's, you know, a painless documentary to watch.
Yeah, there is. I've seen clips from it, and there was a great concert. Well, New York State has not, it is in Governor Cuomo's hands to allow or disallow hydrofracking in the state. It's still under environmental review, and, you know, because of the fuss that's been made. It is allowed in 34 states. Vermont has disallowed it.
Yay, Vermont.
They don't have a lot there anyway, but it's an important stand to take.
Uh-huh.
And New York is a very, very, very pivotal state. If New York says no, it's going to really help.
Right.
Us on the path to renewable energy, I think.
Now, you know, I live on Long Island. You're in the city. You know, and people say to me, well, it's upstate. It doesn't really affect us.
It does
Can
affect you.
Exactly. I know.
It
Can you share with
you.
Our
well,
city eaters why
yeah.
it's important?
Our water, it's our watershed. It's our watershed. And that is the main problem, that there's potentially tremendous corruption of the watershed that will occur. The byproducts of the chemical process leave just chemical waste.
They're putting them in these huge pools.
It's analogous to the CAFO, where you create a tremendous amount of hog waste by having 8,000 hogs in a building and create, you know, make large sewage ponds of the waste, and that poisons the watershed in those areas, and the chemical beds that they're creating are not going to hold. You know, they're lined theoretically, but they're not going to hold. It's going to seep into the water.
Right.
Into the water supply.
And they've already had examples of that happening.
Yes, they have.
You know, in Pennsylvania and other places, Texas, California, where it has leaked out. There's no way to safely dispose of that. The other issue also is that the amount, it's thousands and millions of gallons of water that they are shooting along with the chemicals.
That's right.
So they're taking, we have a limited water supply.
That's right.
So they're taking good fresh water and also, you know, polluting it.
That's right. It's wasteful.
Yeah.
It's wasting our natural resources, and it's very difficult for the, I understand the dilemma of so many of the producers who, you know, the dairy farmers in particular, where it's now costing them more money to produce milk than they're getting for the milk because of the way our federal policy is working. And, you know, people have been working for generations and generations and are now going broke. And so when somebody comes along and says, I'll give you $80,000 an acre for your land, it's very tempting.
Right. Yeah, in this movie, Natalie Merchant in Dear Governor Cuomo, I mean, she was literally crying because she understands, you know. I mean, if someone's ready to write you a check for $1 million, a poor farmer upstate,
yeah.
It's like, oh, my God, you know, and you understand that, you know, to turn down that check is an act of love for your
and great foresight
yeah.
and caring.
Right.
And yet it's hard when you just want to feed your family.
Right.
Hey, well, yeah, it's a tough one.
Yeah, it is. And let's hope, and write to your state representatives and state senators, write to Governor Cuomo, you know, let them know how important it is to you that we do not allow hydrofracking in New York State.
Right.
And
right.
What an important decision it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, they're also trying to pass a bill in New York State to require labeling of genetically modified foods. And unlike Proposition 37 in California, where it has to go to ballot,
mm-hmm.
this is really can be done on a legislative level. And so it's a bill that needs to be passed. So you can also find out information about that. I have it listed on my website where you can click.
It is so important. It is so important, Bhavani.
Yeah.
And I was really disappointed that Proposition 37 failed
so
in California.
But when I just recently heard about that, this bill is being proposed in New York State, and that we could possibly require transparency in New York State and be the first state to do it.
Let's do it.
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
So,
and the campaign will not be. I mean, there was $800 million spent on the campaign by big business in California to prevent to keep it from passing.
Right.
And their approach was not necessarily that we shouldn't label food. It was just that it was the wrong bill, and I was appalled that it, and dismayed that it didn't pass.
Well,
this is
you and I know, but I don't know if everyone realizes that so many of our organic companies are now owned by these big food conglomerates.
Yeah.
That they actually even put money into preventing it from passing.
That's
and
right.
It's just horrible how many organic companies have to boycott now.
That's right. Well, that goes back to our earlier discussion about certified organic. It's not always the most meaningful label.
Right, right. Especially now, you know, you think of the new age, you know, person who cared about the planet starting their company, but then, you know, like so many people, that you sell out because you know, you have this opportunity of someone writing you a big check, but the integrity of your business that you built goes to crap.
You know? It brings to mind, I was at a conference 10 years ago, and there was a speaker named Kenny Ossibel, who runs a conference in California called Bioneers, and he wrote a book called Ecological Medicine, and the workshop was on paradigms of business, and he was talking about, you know, the idea was how do we create new paradigms, new business models in this country, and he was relating it to nature, and he said in nature everything is interconnected, everything is interdependent, everything relates to the thing next to it. You know, there's only one kind of cell in nature whose mission is to only grow, which is the model of American business now, and that's a cancer cell. It's only about growing. That's all it wants to do.
Good and analogy.
It was a very powerful analogy.
Yeah.
And it's important that we, you know, do not... Money is not the only thing to live
it's
for.
It's not the only bottom line.
Yeah.
Right. So important. So important. So what do you think can be done to improve the coordination and distribution between the farmers that are outside of the city and the restaurants in the city so that we can help support the farmers?
Yeah, there's so much, there are many exciting things happening. When I started, worked on Farm to Chef with the New York, it was begun with a grant from the New York State Department of Ag and Markets. You know, it was, and the idea was, because green markets had brought a lot of produce into the city, but we wanted to bring animal proteins in, like how do we get healthy animals? And I didn't understand, for example, why it was less expensive for me to get lamb from New Zealand than from 4 hours north of here. So,
mm-hmm.
And there are lots of reasons for that. But anyway, distribution is one of the problems. Farmers, producers can't get off, especially animal producers, can't leave their farm and their animals to come to New York, right? So we need to create distribution systems to get the product here. And there are now so many more. In the past 5 years alone, there have been a great explosion, and the web has really helped this.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are now web-based models of distribution, so producers can work directly with we have one that's for chefs called the Farmer's Web, where we, you know, they work with the producers, but the web-based business, Farmer's Web, handles the bookkeeping and the logistics of bookkeeping and matching, but the producers themselves actually figure out their distribution. So some Hudson Valley Fresh, for example, is distributing with another milk company called Bartlett's, and there some producers will ship directly UPS. So there are different kinds of distribution systems. We have a fish purveyor, Seat to Table, who is now actually starting a retail business, and so anybody can go online and order from them.
What's that called?
Seat to Table.
Uh-huh. Seat
to Table for fish.
Oh.
And what they're it's a family-owned business, and what they are doing is working with sustainable fisheries all around the country, and they work directly with the fishermen and the fisheries at the docks, and then they ship to chefs via FedEx. So what they realized was that driving trucks around was not efficient for them, and that they should leave that to the experts in distribution. And
mm-hmm.
FedEx is an expert in distribution.
Right.
So what they do is focus on finding the fish, finding the fishermen who are fishing in a sustainable way, and then connect them to the chefs, and then the shipping is done via FedEx. And that's a very good, viable system, actually. If it's you know, within 300 miles, it's done by truck, and if it's further, then it's done by air.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are launching, as I said, a retail section as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can have frozen wild Alaskan salmon delivered to your door.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
The professional
model. I know
there's
a website, Eat Wild or Wild Eat. Do you know that one? Wild, I think.
Uh-huh.
And that's all about humanely raised, sustainable animal. And, you know, I cook predominantly vegetarian, so I don't need it very often.
Yeah.
But I know when my daughter was getting married, I wanted her fiancé at the time was not vegetarian. I was going to do an Indian feast, and he wanted lamb curry. So I was
uh-huh.
like, okay,
yeah.
Well, I know there's local lamb, and I'm going to... And that website was great. I was able to find all these local purveyors.
Wonderful.
Which ones came into the city, which ones would ship to me, and it was, you know, really helpful, and I could compare the price, because, you know, again, when you're cooking for a lot of people, price is an issue. You know, when you're buying just a pound for your family, I mean, it's still an issue, but not as much as an issue as when you're buying for 150
That's
people.
That's right.
So...
There's another web-based platform called The Good Egg, which is launching in San Francisco, and that's coming to the New York area as well, which is kind of, it's a software that's kind of like Etsy,
mm-hmm.
So that it works with, they are going to vet all the producers for the provenance of their product, and then, you know, the consumer orders, I don't like the word consumer, creator, is another name, because we actually create the change, so can purchase directly from the producer through the website.
Well, it's great. You know, the web is definitely, you know, helping. You know, it's nice to know that it's good for something.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
So
we didn't get to talk about the property that you bought upstate or about your concessions in Battery Park. We're going to have you on again.
Well, thank you. I would love that, Bhavani. Thanks so much. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking with you. Everyone, I've been talking with Mary Cleaver from the Cleaver Company and the Green Table. And keep doing the work you're doing, Mary.
Thanks,
so great and important.
Yeah, you too.
So glad we met.
Likewise.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And everyone out there, have a great rest of the week. Get involved in your local issues, whether it's GMOs, fracking, but get involved and take a stand and purchase put your politics into your fork. Have a great week.